summarize
a little bit
the structures, the structure of the equations. Okay, so we have seen that the ingredients used in writing these equations are, so on one side we have a set of variables, which are the space-time coordinates. And then there is a set of auxiliary twister-like internal variables, which are two sets, y alpha, y bar alpha dot, and z alpha, z bar alpha dot, which sometimes I will denote to be short as capital Y, capital Z. And so these are some internal twisters. And in this space, Vasilev defines a star product, which on general functions of these internal variables can be defined to act in the following way as an integral representation in particular on monomials. This implies, for example, that y alpha star y beta is y alpha y beta plus epsilon alpha beta, and z alpha star z beta is z alpha z beta minus epsilon alpha beta, and similarly for the dotted variables. And then there is also a non-trivial star contraction between y's and z's, which is y alpha z beta minus epsilon alpha beta. Okay. And one important object which is needed to write down the equation is this Kleinian function, which is e z alpha y alpha, and then the complex conjugate z bar alpha dot y bar alpha dot, which has the properties that it squares to one under star product, and it acts on functions of y and z. If you act on the left and on the right, this just flips the signs of y and z. Similarly for k bar. Okay, so this is the basically the set of variables we use to define the equations. Then we have a set of master fields, so these are a one form in space-time, which I called W. So this is a one-form in space-time. Then there is a one-form in this auxiliary Z-space. And then there is a scalar master form. This is a scalar. And so we have said last time that the physical fields in the end, the physical degrees of freedom, are contained in the projection of these master fields down to z equals 0. So z alpha equals z bar alpha dot equal to 0. In particular, the w at z equal to 0. So this one, again, will have an expansion in y's. and the component of W, which has S minus 1 plus N, S minus 1 minus N, in undotted and dotted indices, with N goes from minus S minus 1 to S minus 1. This contains the generalization of Wilbein and spin connections to the case of higher spins. So this we said last time. And the B, so the B, there is a B, a component which does not depend on, which does not have any y alpha and y bar alpha dot. This is a scalar field in the bulk. And then there are higher components which contains generalized by curvatures. So in particular, the equivalent of Weyl tensor for spin S is contained at n equal to 0. And higher n's are related by the equations of motion to derivatives of the Weyl tensor. Okay. Okay, so so the equations. The most compact way to write them is to put together W and S into a one form in the X and Z space, and then the equations read as follows. Where pi is some operation, some discrete operation which acts on a function of y, y bar, z, z bar, dz, dz bar, by flipping the signs of y, z, and dz. Okay, and so this twist is basically what Vasilev called, well, this field B lives in a twisted adjoint representation due to this twist here. If there was no pi here, this would be a standard covariant derivative for an adjoint field, but Vasilev noticed that you need to put such a twist in order to get the right physical equations of motion. Okay, so this is a twisted adjoint. And this, so the gauge symmetries are almost manifest in this action. So here, this differential D act on X and Z. A big Z is Z alpha and Z bar alpha dot. Okay. And, okay. One further thing that I should specify is that in the bosonic model, these fields are restricted so that they contain only integer spins. So in particular, W is an even function of Y and Z, and S is an odd function. Okay, so this is a constraint which basically tells us that there are only integer spins in the spectrum. And actually, it's needed for the consistency of these equations. If you study the, so to check if these equations are self-consistent, you would, for example, act with D on the first equation and see whether it's compatible with the second equation. And to show that, you do need this kind of constraint. So if you want to describe model with fermionic higher spins, it's not enough to just relax with constraint. You actually need to write down a more general formalism in which you need to add a further set of internal variables which are fermionic. Okay, I'm not going to discuss the fermionic case. Okay. And so here, I want to keep this. As usual, I never find the eraser. Anybody see it? Okay. Yes. So here, this is, in general, a family of theories which are parameterized by a choice of this function. And we have seen last time that this function can be put in the form. Well, Vasilev showed that it can be put in the following form. Where theta is some real phase, which is it's an even star function, so it has an expansion of the star. Okay. So we have an infinite family of theories parameterized by a choice of phase theta of x by some function, and these theories have different interactions, so they are inequivalent theories. But if you impose that there is some parity symmetry in your theory, you find that you can only achieve that if, so for parity, then you can only achieve that if theta of x is equal to zero and the scalar master form is parity even. And this is called the type A in the literature. Or theta of x is equal to pi over 2, and B is parity odd. This is called type B. Okay. But more general, you may not want to impose parity invariance, and then you, as I said, you will have a more general class of theories. Okay. Okay, let me, any question before I go on? Okay, let me just write down these equations a little bit more explicitly in terms of the master fields, because this is maybe a compact form which is maybe too simple, a little bit deceiving. So actually, those equations hide several equations for these master fields. So let me write them down explicitly. If you just split that A into W plus S and write down all the components that you have there, see that basically this equation tells you that the only component of the curvature of A which is non-zero is the one along dz square and dz bar square. So other components are going to be zero, in particular, W is a flat connection, and then there is a mixed XZ component which gives you this equation, then the z square component is this equation. So let me, for simplicity, pick f of x equal to x. So I just specified the type A model, but you can, of course, write down the same equation more generally. Okay, so these are the what you get from the curvature equation there. And the second line gives two equations. And finally, this equation. Okay. So these are the Basilev's equations written down a little bit more explicitly in terms of the master field. And so just one comment. If you look in the literature, you don't always find the equations written in this form, as Nima was saying last time. So basically, what you can do is also shift S, redefine your S as S plus Z alpha dz alpha plus z bar. And if you do this shift using the fact that under star product, the star commutator of z, the generic function of y and z, this is equal to minus d dz alpha on the function, you can check that this is true using the definition of the star product. In particular, you see if you put monomials here, it's clear that this equation is true. So whenever you have a star commutator with z alpha on a function, that is basically the derivative of the function with respect to z. So if you do this sort of shift, you can basically take into account all these derivatives with respect to z. And so, yeah. You get zero, yes. Because... Well, because if you take the commutator, this is going to be zero. So if you take y alpha star z beta minus z beta star y alpha, you get minus epsilon alpha beta from here. I'm not sure if this signs. It's a plus. Okay. Yeah.
Yes?
No, the second one, the derivative.
There is a factor of 2, actually.
Okay.
Factor of 2 because this is the star contraction. When you take the commutators, you double that factor. So that's the factor of 2. Okay, so you could redefine S in this way, then all this redefinition does is to basically fill all the derivatives with respect to Z, this, and this, and it shifts this right-hand side by a constant, which I believe is 1/4 in my conventions. Anyway, this is just a comment. In case you have seen Basilev's equations written in different forms, they are just related by a simple redefinition of S. Okay, so these equations, well, you can immediately see that they admit a solution, which is the ADS vacuum, which is just B equal to 0, S equal to 0, and W equal W naught, which is the combination of V-line and spin connection. ADS, as we have seen in previous lectures. he satisfies the W naught plus W naught star W naught is equal to zero, and all other equations are satisfied if you just put B equal to zero and S equal to zero. And so this B equal to zero is consistent with the interpretation of that I don't have it here anymore, of B as containing bicurvatures of the gauge field, because we know that on the ADS vacuum, the vial tensor vanish. So this is why B is zero there, why it's consistent with the interpretation of B as a curvature, a vial curvature. Okay. Now you can start from this vacuum and study fluctuations around this vacuum and look at those equations for the dynamics of fields around this vacuum. Okay? All right. Okay. So maybe these equations look simple because they are just first-order differential equations, at least. But that's what, in the way I've written them. But in fact, it's a quite complicated system of equations, which, through this expansion into the internal variables, actually hides an infinite set of equations for all those physical fields and auxiliary fields. So, yes. So you may also wonder, how can you get second order equations for the physical fields if these are just first order differential equations? So the point is that there is an infinite chain of equations, and solving for the auxiliary fields, you get second order equations. This is what Vasilev called the unfolded dynamics. And I guess the name unfolded just means that you are supposed to unfold these equations in terms of that infinite chain of fields and solve them and write down equations for physical fields. So just to illustrate how this works, let me give a very simple example of a toy model in which one can write down an unfolded formulation. It's probably too simple, but it illustrates how, in general, these things work. So the structure of this unfolded systems, in general, is that you have a set of dynamical equations, which include derivatives with respect to space-time. In this case, it would be the first, the second, and the fourth equation. And then there is a set of equations which do not involve derivatives in space-time, which are basically constraint equations, which are this and this. These do not have any derivative with respect to x, and you can also, if you want, eliminate the derivative with respect to z by doing that shift. So this, you can view them as a set of algebraic constraints on your master fields. So that's the general structure. You have some dynamical equations and some constraints. So let me illustrate how this works in a very simple case, which is the Klein-Gordon equation in flat space. Okay, so we all know Klein-Gordon equation. Let me take the massless equation. We have this equation. It's a second-order equation for this scalar field. And so to write it in a form which is similar in spirit to this, we can introduce a set of auxiliary variables, y, so this play the role basically of the y alpha y bar alpha dot there. I don't need to use the two component spinor notation for this example because it's very simple. So let me just use a set of vector coordinates. And then we can define some master field, phi, x, and y, which will have an expansion as those master fields of Vasilev's we'll have an expansion in powers of y. Right? And in general, you have all orders there. You have an infinite set of fields included here. Now, so the claim, well, it's a very simple thing, so it's not really a big claim. But the point is that you can write the Klein-Gordon equation in terms of this master field as a first-order differential equation in the space-time, so an equation like this. So this is the dynamical equation, which is equivalent to those equations involving dx. And then there is a constraint equation, which is this. So this constraint means that we want to constrain this field to be traceless. So we constrain those fields to be traceless. Okay. So the claim is that this set of equations is completely equivalent to the Klein-Gordon equation for the bottom component of this field. And so the way to see that is just to expand these equations in powers of y and see what do they imply. So at first order in y, you have that d dx mu phi, I identify phi with the first component here, which has no y. Okay? So that tells you that d dx mu phi is equal to phi mu, where phi mu is the first one, the one which is linear in y. Okay? And then you go on. So the second equations would tell you that the one which is linear in y on both sides will tell you that dx mu phi nu is equal to phi mu nu, where phi mu nu is the one quadratic in y. Okay. And now we are basically done imposing that this is traceless, which is the constraint. So taking the trace of this equation, you get that d dx mu phi mu is equal to 0. But phi mu by the first equation is equal to d dx mu phi. So this is just the Klein-Gordon equation for the first one, the bottom component of the master field. And if you go on in the chain, the left equations don't tell you anything new. They just tell you that in general, this component is related to derivative of the bottom one. And there is no new dynamical content in the next equations. Okay, so this is an extremely simple example of how unfolding works. And so in this case, this is just a free equation. It's just a trivial rewriting of the equation. There is really no gain in doing this. But it turns out that this formalism is the one in which it's more natural, easier to write down a nonlinear theory with interactions. You want to know if there is any set of equations that you cannot unfold?
I think you may be able to
apply this to any equation, any dynamical equation that you know. It might not be so easy as the example I presented here, but I think in general you can unfold any equation. You can do it for gravity also. Well, it's basically contained in these equations. The spin 2 part of these equations is an unfolded version of gravity. Not Einstein gravity, there is some corrections, but Yes, you could do it for pure gravity too.
Not sure. I think
I don't know if you learn something. Perhaps there. I think Vasiliev has written down some. Well, for example, black hole solutions in pure gravity, in this unfolded formulation, and I guess somehow that's then easier to generalize the higher spin case. I'm not sure in the case of pure gravity, what do you in practice gain by doing this?
Gauge invariance manifest and
So the gauge invariance of this equation is manifest. Yes, we just write them in form of Young-Mills-like equations, so you can see the gauge invariance, and you can see that this reduces to at a linearized level to the higher spin gauge invariance. So, yes, the point is that in this formalism, it's easier to write down a consistent linear theory. But, of course, if you unfold it, then it does include second-order equations with some interactions, so if somebody else had a vision, he could have written down those two. But yes, that's Vasiliev's intuition that this fourth relation is the most natural one to tackle this problem. Okay. So, as I said, so this, in a very simplified setting, is essentially what's going on in those equations. And in particular here, so a couple of comments, we see that in this unfolded formulation is basically the constraint which encodes the non-trivial dynamics. If you don't put these constraints of tracelessness, then this system is just an empty system, just tells you that the fields are all related in that way, but that's all. It doesn't give you the second order equation for phi. So the constraints are essential to get the right equations. And there the constraints are these two equations, and in particular the non-trivial one is this one, which contains this choice of interaction function, which here I just chose to be the simplest one. Okay. The other comment is that we see here that in this unfolded formulation, what we have is typically that there is a relation between derivatives in space-time and derivatives in some internal space. And that's also what's going on there in a little bit more complicated setting. But in general, we do have relations that connect, let me say, for example, for B, connects derivatives in space-time with derivatives in the twister variables. Now, in this case, there is nothing really deep behind this fact, but here, the point is that we have this star product, and the star products are non-local in the internal space, which means that these star products contain an infinite number of derivatives on the fields by expanding that integral representation. You can equivalently write as some kind of expansion in derivatives. So there are all possible derivatives with respect to the internal variables. But the internal variables are related by the equations to, well, derivatives in the internal variables are related to derivatives in space-time, which means that effectively those equations include all derivatives, arbitrary high number of derivatives in space-time. So there is a non-locality of this theory. So this sort of relations imply that non-locality in Y gives a non-locality in space-time. This happens at the interacting level. if you expand at linearized order around ADS, then you just have at most two of these derivatives. And so the linearized equations are just local, like Fronsdahl equations. Now, locality comes in interactions. So interactions in these theories include an infinite power of higher derivative corrections in general, due to these kind of relations, basically.
I mean, I'm never going to implement that projection. You're just this statement about this is a convenient set of fields to think about when I'm thinking about the theory. Or, I mean, it's clear Z plays a different role than Y, but I don't see, you know, my sense is that I'm just going to, you know, solve these equations and somehow it'll focus down on these fields as opposed to ones that carry
the that's a prescription. I mean, it's an interpretation proposed by Bazzi. You're supposed to get physical fields from that slice, the z equal to zero slice. It's possible that somebody may find some more general way of thinking about these equations, maybe. But this is the way that he proposed to interpret these equations.
Okay.
And so let me just say that this projection, this z is, even though in the end you project to z equal to zero, they do play a non-trivial role in these equations due to the star products. For example, if you have a term which is y alpha star z beta, and then you project this to z equal to zero, this is not zero. So you're supposed to take the star products before doing this projection. This is epsilon alpha beta,
or minus, as follows from those equations.
So the z's do play a non-trivial role in the equations, even though in the end, after you've computed all your star products, you project the z equal to zero.
Okay, I think I misinterpreted that. I'm going to calculate this, expand it out, those five equations on the top there. But then at the end of the day, before I start examining in more detail, I project any kind that has a z in it, I throw away.
Right.
So
the higher components which have some z dependence are, you can view them as auxiliary fields, sure, which is related to the physical fields by the equations themselves. So you components of these fields which have some z dependence are auxiliary fields. They will be related to physical fields. If you just think this is
throwing them away, or are the equations just, I'm solving for them kind of the same way I solved for?
You don't need to look at them. If you want, they are related to the physical fields, but to know the equations for the physical fields, you just need to project.
Okay. Yeah. So I could just solve for them, but I'd be doing a lot of extra work with it.
Yes.
Okay.
They don't give you any new information.
Okay.
Do you have enough gauge symmetry like to fix it to zero? Is it independence or not? It's really just fixed by the equation.
You cannot gauge everything away. Okay, I deleted the gauge symmetry. So that there was a gauge symmetry here with a parameter which depends on y and z. You can use the z-dependent part of this gauge symmetry to basically impose that the field S vanish when z alpha is z bar. So you can choose, you can use the gauge prism to choose this one, which means that the S is purely auxiliary field, it does not have any physical component.
Then any such theory must be non-local. Cannot be local.
Any such theory, you mean?
Any closed or this infinite space.
Right, and yes. So this happens through this star product. And it's sort of expect, and well, it's expected that you need higher derivative interactions for higher spin fields by dimensional grounds. What perhaps is not expected is that you need all orders, basically. It doesn't truncate to a finite number of derivatives at each order. You have possibly an infinite number of derivatives. And you can use the cosmological constant to make things dimensionless.
Is it in some sense expected from the string theory point of view?
Perhaps.
Why does people try to write an action for it if it's not local?
You can write an action.
Action is still useful if it's not local. Like the equation of motion.
Or what do you gain? Like an equation of motion from price over from one. So action, you emphasize the locality.
But if you had to compute like partition function and things like that, it's ultra dimensional.
It is action. I mean, it's a bit like non commutative gauge theories, for example. Do you?
Yes. Non-commutative you have a scale which about it you have a locality.
Okay, good.
Number of derivatives, like all types of three fields, there's cubic coupling between all three different fields.
Right. I think so. So it's a bit. Okay, it's not so easy to translate these equations into that language, but I think so. At the cubic level, you already have all number of derivatives.
But in fact, we know that, right? From the boundary, we know that these currents, any spin, if the spins are non zero.
Yeah, but that alone, I don't think it tells you that you have all possible derivatives, right?
If you want to have a scalar with a spin S field, two scalars with spin S field,
you need S derivative. Yeah, S
is unbounded.
Oh, I was thinking about for fixed S.
Even for fixed S, you say?
I think so, yeah. Well, okay. So as I said, this is not so transparent from the equations. Even Vasilev himself, in his reviews, he says that the theory is probably non-local at the interacting level. I think it is non-local at the interacting level. But yes. I guess you would break higher spin gauge symmetry if you start playing with that. Add some mass.
Infinite string length. is that. That's great.
Yeah, find a string length, then you have massive higher strings instead. Yeah. So you don't have gauge fields. That one, you don't have a higher string gauge. Yeah, but you could study that kind of field too.
I mean, this is very non-trivial because here it's really a truncation just to the massless gauge. So it's not discontinuous. To give mass, you introduce more degrees of freedom. So it's not. I think it's not very well known how to. Not known how to put a new parameter and mass in this.
No, I don't think it's. Yes, but it doesn't mean that you cannot do it in principle. I think you could do it. Yes, not so. Not so easy to deform the structure of this equation in some consistent way. I mean, they seem to be quite rigid, difficult to accept for this choice of function, which I mentioned before. The structure seems to be very constrained. But that doesn't mean that you cannot do it in principle. Just that I don't think anybody knows how to do it. Okay, so let me just try a little bit the structure of the linear. So as I said, to really show that these equations describe propagation of higher spin gauge fields, one should study the equations for linearized fluctuations around this vacuum solution and show that they do indeed give the quadratic Fransdahl-like equations for the higher spin gauge field. And this, in fact, is a bit non-trivial to show and was one of the main results of Vasiliev in the mid-80s. Let me just sketch what's the structure of the linearized equations. So you write your W as W naught plus fluctuation, and we keep only the linearized one, and B, so B naught is zero, so it starts as a linearized piece, and S naught is zero, and so on. Yeah, so again, in my way of writing the equations, the vacuum expectation value of S is zero. In this equivalent way of writing the equations, then the vacuum expectation value of S will be that minus Z dZ, and so on. I just usually prefer to write them in this form. Okay, so if you linearize those equations, keeping only linearized orders, then you get the first equation is this, where so D naught is a covariant derivative built using this vacuum part of the W, so it's D W1 plus W0 star W1 plus W1 star W0. I'm just expanding that equation. So that's the first one. Then the second one tells you that the derivative with respect to Z of W is equal to minus D0 S1, where D0 is the same covariant derivative. And the third one tells you that the Z of S1 is equal to D1 star K dZ square plus K bar dZ bar square. And then you have the fourth equation. We write it as this, D naught Twiddle, where Twiddle is due to this twisted adjoint representation. So the D naught Twiddle on B is DB plus the pi commutator means that you take W naught star B minus B star pi W naught. So that's the D0 tilde. And then you have dz b1 is equal to 0. So these are the linearized equations.
Okay. So how do you solve them? So start from the simplest one. So this one just tells you that V1 is a function of x and y only. It does not depend on z. Okay. Then you move to this equation. You solve for S1 as a function of B1. And the solution to that equation, so you get S1 as a function of B1, and the explicit solution, just to give you an idea of what kind of calculation one need to do, can be written in this form. So this action of kappa, I don't have kappa here anymore. You can check that what it does is switching y and z, changing the sign of z. And then you put, after you complete the star product, you put z to tz, and you have this integral. And you can check that if you take dz of this expression, you reproduce b star k dz square plus b star k dz bar square. And here, as I mentioned before, I have used the gauge freedom to set S1 at z equal to 0 to be equal to 0. This is a gauge fix using the z-dependent part of the gauge transformations. So you can do that. So that's the equation for S1. Then you go to this equation, and so it's convenient to split this W1 as a z-independent part. Let me call it with a different letter to avoid confusion. So let's split W1 as a z-independent part plus a z-dependent part, which is going to be 0 when you set z equal to 0, okay? Just by definition of how I split it. Then this equation basically determines W1, this W1 prime, the z-dependent part of W1, as a function of S1. So you get W1 prime as a function of S1, which then by this equation gives you W1 prime as a function of B1. Okay, I'm not going to write down the explicit solution. It's similar to this type of integral representation, but it's a similar type of equation that you solve here. The difference is that this is a one form in the Z space and this is a zero form in the Z space. But the technique to solve it is similar. Okay, and then
why isn't it just z alpha dz alpha times v star k? Why do you need the integral?
Well, v depends on z.
No, that v did not depend on z.
No, I mean v star k depends on z.
Yeah. First, can you tell me
v does not depend? You're right, but v star k depends on z because k depends on z. Oh, kappa, I should call it kappa. Kappa is just, remember, is this special Kleinian function, which is easy after a while. Okay, then, so you go to your first equation. And to look for the physical equation of motion, you project it down to z equal to 0. And that projection tells you that d0 of omega, omega is the z independent part of W1, by So you write W as omega plus W1 prime, and then you can bring W1 prime to the left-hand side. So this tells you that so this is basically what I was saying before, is that so even though those equations in the beginning, they look like zero curvature conditions for W, like the original one, like this one, but through this Z dependence and the star product, you actually in the end for the physical field, you produce a non-trivial right-hand side for your equations. So D0 of omega is equal to this guy, which is a function of B. And explicitly, this is takes the following form. If you go through the calculation, yes, C is the Poincaré, it's the ADS radio coordinate in Poincaré code. So this is what you get from the first equation, and then we still have this equation for B1, D0 tilde. So that equation is BB plus W0 star B star pi W0. This is the fourth equation, yes. Okay. Well, I just write this a little bit. So if you want to write this in terms of the spin connection and Willebine of ADS, this will take a form. I should put a B1 everywhere. Okay. So here, omega naught is the spin connection of ADS, which is quadratic. It has a piece which is quadratic in y, and a piece which is y bar, and that's the Willebine, which is goes like y bar. This anti-commutator comes out because of this pi twist. If you didn't have that pi twist, this would be just a commutator. And so that's the important part here. These equations. Okay, so again, since this, so basically omega naught, as I said, is omega naught alpha beta, y alpha, y beta, plus complex conjugate. So in doing these star commutators with the y's, you basically replace this commutator with derivatives on B1 with respect to y. And or y bar for the complex conjugate, and similarly here. So that this is what I was commenting before, that these equations relate derivative of B to derivatives with respect to y. So here at the linearized level, this background spin connection and Wilbein are just quadratic in the y, which means that you only have two derivatives with respect to the y, which is why the equations still look local in the end. But in general, at the interacting level, you have all derivatives here. Okay, so now, so the non-trivial part is to show that these two equations are equivalent to Fronsdahl equations for higher spin gauge fields in ADS. And that is basically, as I said before, is one of the main results of Vasilev, and he often calls these two equations the central on-shell theorem. Well, call it a theorem because it's non-trivial to show that these equations are actually equivalent to Fronsdahl. So I'm not going to have time to do the detailed analysis of this. Let me just tell you that what these equations imply. So first of all, they are, as we know, the original equations were consistent. So this, you can check that they are consistent. So the Bianchi identity for this curvature imply are consistent with the second equations. And so what happens that this equation basically is the one which tell you that B1 are related to Weyl curvatures of omega. So omega contains the spin, higher spin gauge fields. This equation tells you that basically derivatives on omega are related to this y. So zero here means that y bar is zero. And here the y is zero. So these equations tell you that the B 2s, 0 component and 0,2s component are basically field strength of omega. And then this equation is just a set of, well, it's just a compatibility equation that you obtain by Bianchi identity. And let me just tell you, in the simple case of spin 1, this is probably more transparent. So in spin 1, yeah, so, yes, I should say that, so this is the general equation, and if you write down the expansion in powers of y, you find that this equation basically can be studied in spin S sectors, they decouple. So this equation you can, so you can look at the component of this equation, which has S minus 1 plus n and S minus 1 minus n, where n, so this is the usual thing that I wrote already a couple of times. So this is, contains all spin S degrees of freedom of omega. And you can look at that equation in that sector. And the second equation splits in a set of infinite equations for each spin S sector, which include all equations for all these fields and basically relate, as in the toy model of the Klein-Gordon field, it relates B2S, 0 to B2S plus 1, 1, and then it relates B2S plus 1, 1 to B2S plus 2, 2, and so on. So for spin 1, yeah.
Those three fields for each fixed S, and they form decoupled set of equations.
Yes.
So these are, here you have coming 2S equations.
Yeah,
and then there are infinite.
And then here are infinite. So for spin 1, we just keep the part of omega which is independent of y and y bar. So it just, in that case, omega is just omega mu, or a mu, if you want to. And that so the first equation, this equation, just tell you that the alpha dot beta is equal to B alpha beta which is basically, well, can identify with the curvature of F alpha beta. Okay. And similarly for the complex, the dotted part. So this equation in the spin one sector just tells you that D of omega is equal to F alpha beta plus F alpha dot beta dot. So it's just a definition of the curvature in terms of the gauge field. And then you, if you act with a derivative on that equation, on this equation, so, and then you use the second equation to relate derivative of B to all these components. And then this, so this you get from the first equation. And combining first plus second equation, you get the Maxwell equations in ADS, where this is the covariant derivative in ADS. Sorry, I don't have much time to go into the details, but I hope it's more or less clear what's going on. So the first equations basically tell you that B is a curvature, and then playing with those equations, like acting with derivatives in various ways, you end up with the dynamical equations. And so the same is true for arbitrary spin. So in that case, you get more equations. You get equations for all these fields. And so some of them are just equivalent to torsion constraints. So you see that this right-hand side, it's only non-zero when you have 2S minus 2 indices here and 0 here. Or 0 here and 2s minus 2 here, which are these guys. So those are, so all the other equations just tell you that several components of these higher spin curvatures are 0. And that's equivalent to a torsion constraint. It allows you to write down the components equivalent to spin connections in terms of Willebinds. So in the end, you use all those equations to go from this set of fields, write them down all in terms of what you would call a generalized field bind with S minus 1 indices and S minus 1 indices. And then for this field, you get an equation which is the equivalent to the, which is the dynamical equation. So this is omega mu alpha 1 alpha s minus 1 alpha dot alpha s minus 1 dot, which is in the case of spin 2 is just the Willebind. In the general case, it's just some generalization of it. And in the end, so as I sketched already the last time, but okay. So then you can, if you want to go back to your vector notation, in which now these are four-dimensional indices, and this is symmetric traceless. And then you, so you can write all the indices to be flat indices using your background inverse Willebind, which I denote as capital E. So you can always use those gauge symmetries which are related to the spin connections to gauge away the anti-symmetric part of this field. And then this get identified with a spin S totally symmetric field, which is the Fronsdahl field. And then if you work hard enough, you show that that field in the end satisfies this equation. Picking a gauge in which this is transverse
becoming traceless. Okay. And then you recognize that these equations are Fronsdahl equations in ADS. They come from the covariantization of the Fronsdahl equation in flat space that I wrote down in the first lecture. So here, I started discussing the spin one case, but the simplest sector of all is just the spin zero sector, which just received contributions from the second equation. So the second equation, in the spin zero sector, you have an infinite chain of equations for your Vn, n, which is similar to the unfolding of Klein-Gordon, which I showed before. And so going through the same kind of calculations, it tells you that, so in the scalar sector, scalar equation is just from the second equation. And it tells you, for example, that B1, 1 is related to derivative of B0, 0, and so on. And so if you unfold that equation in the scalar sector, in the end you find that the scalar field in this theory satisfies this equation. Well, so you could have, well, formally you can see that it's S going to zero limit of this equation, but I don't think there is, in principle, any reason to have expected, well, the spin zero part of these equations is kind of decoupled for the spin S part. They come from different equations. But anyway, you can see that the spin zero can be also viewed as a limit of this one. But the really important point here is that these equations produce for us the Klein-Gordon equation for a scalar field, and the mass of the scalar field is fixed by the equations. It's not a free parameter. It just comes out from the form of this equation. And we get the mass is -2. So this is a negative mass square, but as we know, this in ADS is okay as long as we are above the unitarity bound, which in ADS 4, it's -9/4, I believe. So but the fact that we have this scalar field with negative mass square is now very important from the point of view of holography, because yes, it's the value that is, yeah, corresponds to conformally coupled in ADS. Yes. By the way, this is only true in ADS4. So I didn't discuss the higher dimensional variations of Vasilev theories, but in that case you don't get conformally coupled scalars. Anyway, the really important thing is that this is in a range which is negative mass square, but above the unitarity bound, and in this range, so ADS-FT, we know that this scalar field should be dual to some scalar operator in the boundary, and with dimension delta, where delta is delta, in general, delta minus t is equal to mass square, right? Which, so in our case, we find for d equal 3, and m square is equal to -2, we find that delta is 3/2 plus minus 9/4 -2. And the two solutions are delta equal to 1 and delta equal to 2. And you see that they are both solutions are above the unitarity bound for a scalar operator in three dimensions.
So, well, usually in the general case where m squared is positive, you always have a single choice for the normalizable mode of the scalar field. Here you have that both choices are allowed. So you have two inequivalent possible quantizations. So let me call this scalar field phi. So as we know from the wave equation, the Klein-Gordon equation, it follows that this goes like z to the delta plus times some function of x plus z to the delta minus times some function beta of x. And as I said, usually you would choose the delta plus boundary condition to be the normalizable mode of this field, and you would say that away from sources, the field goes like, well, away from sources, you impose the boundary condition that beta of x is equal to 0. And so then as standard interpretation in the SCFT is that this alpha of x is related to the VEV of the dual operator. With dimension delta plus, and beta of x is related to a source that you can add in your boundary theory. And close to the source, the field goes like z to the delta minus. Okay, so this is when delta minus is negative or below the unitarity bound, this is the only possible choice that you have. But now we have two possible choices. So we can either interpret alpha x as the VEV of the dual operator with dimension delta plus and beta as a source, or the other way around. We can also choose the opposite boundary condition in which the field goes like z to the delta minus away from sources, and then that's the VEV. So this is the usual one, and the alternative one is to say that the operator, the scalar is dual to, so this is what, this is delta minus and this is delta plus in the notations. Alternative one is that alpha of x is related to a source and beta of x is the VEV of the operator with dimension delta minus.
Yes, away from your sources. Yes. Okay. Yes. So here, on the other hand, in the higher spin sector, if you look at how the solutions of this equation behave close to the boundary, so in that case you are.
So let me split this index A here as z and xi, where xi is the coordinate on the boundary. Then the component of phi with s components, s coordinates along the boundary, is dual to some current in the boundary theory. And so you see, you find that the equations tells you that this goes close to the boundary, like z to the delta plus minus. Actually, let me call it bit cut again. And delta plus minus, so delta plus is s plus 1, and delta minus is 2 minus s. So in this case, for higher spins, you see that this one at spin 2 is 0 and then become negative. In that case, the only possible solution for normalizable mode is this one, which tells you that these higher spin gauge fields are dual to some currents at the boundary, which have a dimension s plus 1, which is the correct dimension for a higher spin conserved current in a free theory, as we have seen in the first lecture. Okay. Okay, so now let me summarize these conjectures relating these theories to some CFT, some vector models at the boundary. So these are Klebanov, Polyakov, and Setskin, Sandel conjectures. Okay. So there are several of these conjectures. Well, they are all related, but so the first one is that this that the minimal type A Vasilev theory in ADS4. So minimal here refers to a truncation in which you only keep even spins. So as I mentioned a couple of times, there is a consistent truncation in which you can restrict your master field to include only even spins. And type A is that choice of B star K as opposed to I B star K, and the parity of the scalar field. So this is dual to a free ON vector model. In the singlet sector. So this restriction is kind of important to really state the duality, because there are no non-singlet, there are no candidates in the bulk theory which can be dual to non-singlet operators in this vector model. So this restriction means that you are really only looking at ON invariant operators in the theory. And a possible way to implement that is to gauge the ON and then take a gauge coupling to zero, which decouple the gauge field but still leaves a constraint that you should only look at gauge invariant operators. So this is the simple theory of n real scalar field with some ON symmetry, and this single trace singlet operators are a scalar of dimension 1. Recall that in 3 dimensions, the engineering dimension of a scalar field is 1/2, as you can see from the action. And then there are higher spin currents. Which I wrote down in the first lecture, which are symmetric traceless and are conserved. Okay, and these guys in the bulk correspond to the scalar field with a delta equal to 1 boundary condition. So we choose the boundary condition. We choose the delta minus boundary condition, which means that we want our scalar field to be dual to an operator of dimension 1, which matches with the dimension of that operator in the free theory. And the J's are dual to those higher spin fields. Okay. And this in the ON theory where phi's are real, this is only non-trivial for even spins. The ones with odd number of derivatives are either vanish or they are a descendant of the other current. Okay. They are trivial in this real case. But you can see, for example, the spin 1 case is just 0 because the spin 1 would be phi I d mu phi I minus d mu phi I phi I. It's just 0. In a complex theory, it will not be zero. And the higher ones, I think they're either zero or you can write them as total derivatives of lower even currents. So they are descendant. Okay? So this is one conjecture. Then it's, of course, natural to ask, so what if we take the alternative boundary condition for the scalar? So 2 is that the minimal, or the same model, minimal type A, but with delta equal to 2 boundary condition for the scalar. So the conjecture, when this was observed, was proposed first by Klebanov and Polyakov, while the free theory version of the duality was already implied in some earlier papers of Setkin and Sandor. So, but Klebanov and Polyakov observed that in this case, the candidate for the CFT dual is just a critical point. So it's a IR fixed point of the ON vector model deformed by a relevant, well, with relevant deformation. So you can deform your free ON vector model by some relevant deformation. Phi to the fourth interaction, or lambda, so in three dimension here as dimension 1, so it's a relevant deformation in the IR. So this basically, so this is not special to this example. It's a general story that whenever you have a double trace deformation of your theory, so this is the equivalent of a double trace deformation in a joint theory, for example, that guy, then the theory flows to interacting IR fixed point in which the dimension of the scalar operator in the theory goes from 1 to 2, plus 1 over n corrections. And there are higher spin currents which have dimension s plus 1 plus 1 over n corrections. And okay, so this general story is to Klebanov, Witten, and also Gabser, Klebanov. So now we see what are the candidates for the duals of those operators in theory with this boundary condition. So again, it's just the scalar field, which now has this alternative boundary condition, is going to be dual to this operator in the critical theory. And then there are the higher spin currents. Sorry, the higher spin gauge fields. So, but now here we see already an important difference between this conjecture and this conjecture is that here in the CFT side, we expect to have non-trivial 1 over n corrections to the dimensions of these operators, while in the free theory, there is nothing which can correct the dimension of those operators. There are no 1 over n corrections. So from the bulk point of view, this means that if you study one-loop diagrams in the bulk, for example, the self-energy correction of a spin S gauge field, it means that if you have, let's say, a delta equal to 2 scalar here exchanged in the loop, then this diagram should produce some non-trivial mass term for this higher spin gauge field and give these anomalous dimensions here in the CFT side. So this would be a 1 over n effect in the bulk. So there is a coupling constant here which goes like 1 over square root of n. On the other hand, if you consider a similar diagram in that theory with delta equal to 1 scalar exchange, that somehow is supposed to not give any non-trivial correction to this mass. So this is something which is, it's quite non-trivial in general. You would expect that if you compute this, there will be some corrections. So if this conjecture is true, then it must be true that all loop corrections on the bulk side, when you choose this boundary condition, should vanish. That's far from obvious, and nobody so far has ever been able to tackle loop corrections in this theory. But it's something that eventually should be checked if these conjectures are really true. Okay. And then, so there are...
Here? You can, if you want to redefine lambda, you can.
No, the for this.
I mean, the critical point lambda goes to infinity. And you can find lambda at lambda. You have exactly analogous conjecture for the type B models, in which you choose the. I need to stop.
Let me just say this.
Two, three minutes.
In 15 minutes, why? And it goes the other two.
Okay, I'll just say it very fastly. So you have analogous of these two conjectures in the type B models. In that case, you have that the type B with delta equal to 2 boundary condition. This is dual to a theory of free ON fermions. So this is a theory of free fermions. It has a scalar operator, which is just psi I, psi I. It has dimension 2. In three dimension, the psi has dimension 1. Right. Yes. And then there are higher spin currents, which have the following form. Okay. So this is supposed to be dual to this type B model with delta equal to 2 boundary condition. So you have your scalar field, which is now parity odd. And so you choose this, it's dual to that operator. And then there are higher spin currents, which again are dual to those guys with dimension s plus 1. And then the alternative, delta equal to 1 boundary condition for the scalar, is due again to some deformation of this theory. And the deformation, so in this case you have the critical point of basically Grosnovo action, in which you have your psi to the fourth interaction. And so this is now interaction which is relevant in the UV. So in this case, you have a flow from IR theory, which is free, to a UV theory, which is interacting. And in this theory, you have a scalar operator, which has dimension 1, plus 1 over n correction. So again, this will be dual to the scalar with the alternative boundary conditions, and that's dual to the higher spin current. And now the situation is reversed. You should find that loop corrections with delta equal to 2 scalars don't break the higher spin symmetry, and the delta equal to 1 case break the higher spin symmetry. This is not, it's not impossible, because in the two theories, these couplings are different. The nonlinear cubic couplings are different due to the different choice of function here, which are different to two theories. Okay, so I think I need to stop here.